So I trust you've had a rich day of practice. So our lives are full of habits. Many of our habits help us be healthy and happy, and many of them cause us to have more stress and suffering in our lives. And I have a feeling you've encountered both of those today. The more we do something, the better we get at doing it. So if we judge ourselves and others a lot, we get better and better at being judgmental. It can become a default way of being. But in the same way, the more we appreciate ourselves and others, the better we get at it. And appreciation can become more prevalent in us than being judgmental. And sometimes our habits are so deep, we forget how plastic the mind is, how it can be molded, how just repetition of something alone reshapes it. Guru spoke yesterday about preventing unhelpful states from arising. But when mindfulness isn't consistent because of our lifelong habits, it's quite easy to get caught up in unhelpful states of mind. In meditation, we call these unhelpful states the five hindrances because of they have particular patterns to them. They're universal, and they hinder the mind from seeing clearly. We all have them. We're not wrong for having them. This is just how the human mind is works. So today I'll focus mostly on the second of the four wise efforts, which is abandoning or letting go. And primarily we let go of these five hindrances, which are sensual desire, aversion or ill will, restlessness, sleepiness, and doubt. And again, I'd be surprised if you haven't had at least one of those arise today. What's really fascinating to me is that each one of these hindrances begins with a single thought, with some version of a dissatisfied thought, which then grows from one thought to one of these five familiar patterns. And the shape of these patterns over time, over years, become really well-worn grooves in the brain. So it's really easy to just fall right back into them. I think about how if you've ever experienced just being really just triggered by something, you know, just out of nowhere, all of a sudden you're triggered, you know. And when I grew up, you know, my mother smoked while I was a young child, you know, and I hated it. I hated it. And I remember, you know, how happy I was like in the 90s, you know, when we passed no smoking at work legislation in California, you know, I was ecstatic. It's like, wow, this is fantastic, you know, and you know, one of the things that happened as you'd go out the door of the building you were in, people would be smoking right at the door. And so you'd have to go through this waft of smoke to get to your car. And regardless of what fantastic mood I was in, that smoke would hit me and I'd just be angry. I'd just be angry and indignant. And time after time, you know, it really took, it was such a well-worn groove in my brain. And my guess is that the anger that arose was probably more harmful to me than those 10 seconds of smoke I may have experienced. But that's how those groups work. You know, it's kind of this automatic conditioning that happens. So all these unhelpful mental attitudes arise from some version of dissatisfaction, of wanting things to be different than they are. And as you've probably noticed, our thoughts affect our body. When we have loving thoughts towards someone, pleasurable and healthful chemicals are released in our bodies. So for instance, especially, I know quite a few of you have dogs that I've seen at least the tail here and there. And just petting a dog for 15 minutes can lower the blood pressure by 10% and also the pulse rate. And by the way, it also lowers the blood pressure of the dog if you pet it. So you're doing a lot of benefit by petting the dog. But in the same way, when we're hostile towards someone, when we feel hostile, our body can flood with stress hormones and stress chemicals. And so these hindrances have a powerful effect in the body, whether we notice it or not. And also what I find really fascinating is that even though our thoughts have such a powerful effect on our bodies, the thoughts themselves are so insubstantial. I mean, you can't grab onto a thought. It just kind of comes and goes. It's gone by the time you see it. A thought of a person is just a thought that comes and goes incredibly briefly. A thought of the future, it's just a momentary immaterial idea without substance. But when we have the same kind of thoughts repeatedly, it's easy for thoughts to feel solid and real. And that's how this pattern arising from a single dissatisfied thought becomes a hindrance. It just feels solid. The body gets entrenched in it. And it's an essential skill in the art of meditation to learn to abandon these hindrances when we're caught by them. And it's worth appreciating that these deeply entrenched patterns often have been practiced for decades, and some of us who are on the older side of things. You know, with thought after thought, digging deeper and deeper grooves in the brain. And it can take a lot of resolve and effort to abandon it. Mindfulness gives us the choice. And each time we become mindful that we've lost in a hindrance, each time we let go of a hindrance, we can celebrate because it weakens the tendency to be lost this way. And mindfulness develops its own groove in the brain. Each time we're mindful, we deepen the groove. And as we practice mindfulness over and over, mindfulness eventually becomes the default. So we're more mindful than not. The way my husband put it, he said, with this... it's groovy either way. Yeah. So so when mindfulness is strong, each time the mind begins to go into the hindrances, we can stop and see and make a choice to change tracks. It's an actual choice we make when we say, okay, hindrance, here you are, I see you. In the Buddha's story, I see you, Mara, I see you. Seeing what's there, we're no longer trapped by it. We're no longer lost in it. And the pull of the hindrances weakens over time. I know that when I first started meditating, I'd said one of my early retreats, I know there were periods, sits where I don't think I was mindful for more than the first 1 minute, whereas I was just absolutely lost in thinking for the entire time. And over the years, you know, the ability to come back quickly, much, much more quickly, see it much more quickly, just got easier and easier to set them down. And they stopped being quite as seductive. Even the most uncomfortable and angry and terrible mind states that I was so attached to them. I didn't want to let them go. You know, I wanted to stay angry at whoever I was angry at. I wanted to, you know, that was familiar. It was hard to even want to pull myself away from it. So it gets, the hindrances get weaker over time. Mindfulness gets stronger. And this is something I really want to stress, you know, how we abandon the hindrance is as important as abandoning it. The effort we apply to do so needs to be skillful in itself. It doesn't help at all to be angry at ourselves that we got angry. That just feeds the tendency to get angry. When we find ourselves lost in distraction, how we come back to the present, how we treat ourselves at that moment has a strong effect. If we come back with the idea that we failed, that we blew it, or we feel like a scolded child, you know, then coming back isn't so appealing. It's like coming home from a vacation to a house where we forgot to do the dishes before we left, and there's a big pile of kind of smelly dishes sitting there. You know, that doesn't feel like home. So there's a number of ways of working with the hindrances. In mindfulness practice, the primary way is to get to know it, to recognize it, to be mindful of it. And sometimes just knowing it's there, that's all we need. And the hindrance just kind of dissipates. It's not a strong one. But at other times, we need to look deeper. And we need to consciously allow it to be there, to not be against it, to not make it wrong. It's just something that arose in the mind due to the habits of mind, to conditions. And mindfulness gives us the option to not feed it and not strengthen it further. And if we have strong aversion, we can still be friendly towards our aversion. If the hindrance persists, then we turn to our bodies. We turn our attention to the physical effects of the hindrance. And we're no longer caught by it. We're not lost in it. Well, we are now in the present moment in our physical experience. For instance, if there's aversion or ill will present, we might feel tension, maybe in the chest or abdomen, and we can relax it or soften around it. And as it dissipates, we can gently come back to the meditation object. We don't have to rush back. I used to get whiplash coming back from the hindrance to my breath because I was just in such a hurry to get back. We have a choice about the quality of our minds. Now, really consider that we actually have a choice about the quality of our minds. And remembering, though, that we have a choice is what we need to abandon any strong clinging. Sometimes the contraction is so strong we can't let go. And it can be enough to incline the mind in that direction. For instance, you may get very angry about something and a flood of stress chemicals is released in our bodies. And even though we know we want to calm down, it can take a while for the hormones to flush themselves out, to dissipate. So we can choose not to feed the anger, but we need to have patience for the physical experience of anger to subside. Your thoughts of anger might be gone, but the physicality of it has a lot of momentum. So sometimes it's just you stay with it and have patience with it. Fear is another example, you know, when we're, an example I've often used, you know, if you've ever been in an almost car accident, you know, and you're terrified for a moment, you know, and then you're safe. But boy, your body is still like the heart's pumping, the muscles are, you know, full of blood, you know, the body's ready for fight or flight. And it takes a while to calm down, even though we're safe, even though we know we're safe. So the body's reaction to these things, you know, has a momentum in itself. And there are other times that a hindrance can have such a strong hold on us that we can't work with it directly. And so fortunately, there's some remedies we can use. And I'll touch on a few of these remedies that might be helpful at those times. It's not an exhaustive list. We could spend a week on each one of these hindrances. But I, you know, see if some of them you might pick something up that might be helpful. Gulu mentioned some of them yesterday also, you know, but they're so pervasive, these hindrances. They have an effect on us at every stage of our practice. As we get more and more skilled in practice, the hindrances get subtler and subtler. So it's really worthwhile not thinking, oh yeah, this is the beginning of practice. Once I get good at this stuff, they don't happen. You know, they still arise, but they're just a lot subtler. And so it's worthwhile really getting to know them well. So I'll say a little bit about desire. The desire gives us the delusion that if we just get what we want, then we'll be satisfied. Even if we know what we want isn't helpful. And mostly we can meet desire when it arises and allow ourselves to feel it in the body, you know, to kind of ride it like a wave. We don't have to fulfill it. All desires come and go, even if they're not fulfilled. You know, in meditation, desire might take the form of losing ourselves in a fantasy, in lust, and food craving, or other desire. So some of the remedies is to actually shift the attention to reflect on the truth that sensual pleasure is always temporary. How long will the satisfaction last as the desire is fulfilled? How long did that, you know, this morning's breakfast, the pleasure of that breakfast last? You know, it's not there anymore, right? You know, and really getting in the moment that where you're really feeling the desire that it's temporary. And so sometimes that can be a remedy. And again, remember, with remedies, it's not our go-to isn't a remedy. We're not trying to fix them. But it's really when we're so caught in them that we can't extricate ourselves. We can't see them clearly. A traditional remedy is to focus on the undesirable aspects of what we want. For instance, for lust, you know, the traditional focus is to think about the body's unattractive parts, you know, the feces, saliva, the pus, the urine, the blood, the phlegm, usually contemplating those parts of the physical body kind of takes a little bit out of the feelings of lust. We can reflect on the disadvantages of desire. If we want something that's harmful, we can reflect on the consequences of getting it. Maybe craving potato chips gives us high blood, eating potato chips gives us high blood pressure. And we can reflect on the effects of high blood pressure. So sometimes that can be helpful. I think that, you know, Gulu mentioned just keeping him out of the house works better. But this is what we're talking about. You know, you can prevent it, but when you haven't been able to prevent it, you need to let go of it. So, you know, one of my common things on retreat was always getting caught up in pleasant fantasies that I liked. and spending really nice long periods. You know, they were very pleasant. And, you know, forgetting that I didn't sign up for a silent retreat to spend the fantasizing and not developing meditation, right? So, you know, one of my favorite fantasies that is from Gil, you know, and he said he spent 2 days on a long retreat designing a helicopter. And I'm sure that was really useful. Really useful, but that's what we do. So we're caught in a pleasant fantasy. We need to recommit to our motivation and intention. Remind ourselves how special this time is to develop our practice, to gain insight. So with aversion or ill will, again, we can allow ourselves to feel it until it passes. But when we can't do that, we can apply a remedy. And we can change our focus is one way of doing it. And aversion often arises from one-sided attention. That's when we give the negative aspects of something more attention than necessary. It's a little bit like my favorite analogy is a teenager who has a small pimple on their face. But when they look at the mirror, they see themselves as 95% pimple. And that's what we do with aversion. You know, if there's someone we don't like something about them, that part we don't like about them becomes huge, you know, and they're this unlikable person, but really it's one aspect of it. And we can change our focus and give attention to the positive qualities instead, you know, to the beautiful eyes instead of the little pimple, or how somebody, you know, pets their dog as opposed to the heavy-duty perfume they're wearing. So we can give our attention we can change our focus to something more useful. Now, for me, aversion to pain has always been a very significant hindrance and in my practice. And one of the ways that it's always been helpful is broadening the focus. If there's a pain, for instance, in my knee, you know, there are millions of other sensations in the human body. And, you know, the knee was just this one little area that was hurting. And so I can broaden the focus to include the entire body. It's one way of working with pain. Pain's a lot more complicated than that sometimes, you know. So I don't want you to think that if this doesn't work, there's no other ways of approaching it. But that's one useful way of working with pain. If we're being harsh with ourselves or with someone else, we can bring loving kindness or wishes of goodwill to ourselves or others. Or we can focus on what we're grateful for instead of what's wrong with us. So we can change our focus. So it seems like there's lot of lists of things that we can do, but it's worthwhile, you know, even if some of them just touch you, you know, hopefully they'll be useful. So the next hindrance is sleepiness. And I know that yesterday I heard from a number of you, you had a little bit of sleepiness there, you know, and I appreciate somebody in one of the groups today talked about they fell asleep sitting up, you know, and that amazes me, you know, that to be able to sleep sitting up. So they got a good rest, though, so I was glad about that. So with sleepiness, it's good to resort to be mindful of the body before trying a remedy right away. Sometimes the experience of the body is pleasant, and sometimes it's not pleasant. And so really, if you can, if you've got enough attention, really notice how the body is. Notice, you know, how you actually feel in that moment. Notice what sleepiness is really like. But my go-to with sleepiness, which I think Guru mentioned yesterday, is to take a few deep breaths and sit up a little straighter. Sometimes just the posture can make a difference, you know, just that little extra. The other thing is we can open our eyes, you know, and it's not wrong to open the eyes. You know, here we tend to meditate with our eyes closed, but in Zen, they meditate with their eyes open. Light wakens the system. So we can make a room brighter. You know, I like to generally meditate with a very, very dark room, you know, but if I'm really sleepy, you know, I'll just turn it, make it bright. You know, one way also is you can imagine a white light in the forehead area, and that can increase the energy. You can also count breaths. And for myself, I would just count breaths. I just say, I'm going to just 5 breaths. I had to make it a small goal. If I'm really sleepy, a really small goal is what worked for me. And another, one of the ones that actually makes me laugh when I do it is to pull our earlobes. You know, you pull them just so they hurt, just, you know, not really hurt, just you feel it, you know. And the reason I laugh is because, you know, there's all these statues of the Buddha with long earlobes. And, you know, I just imagine that he was just so sleepy in practice, he just kept yanking and yanking, you know. And so, yep, I'm just like Buddha, you know, hey. So, you know, and humor always got me out of sleepiness. You know, anytime humor always brought my energy up. Another option people don't realize sometimes that it's a real valid way of meditating is to do standing meditation. And it's a lot harder to fall asleep standing than sitting. For myself, if I were to do standing meditation, I'd want to have my hands resting on a chair in front of me. You know, makes it a little bit more stable. And, you know, and also I just want to mention, you know, for some of us who can, you know, get a little bit deep into accomplishment, sometimes sleepiness arises because we need more sleep, you know, and a skillful nap might be called for. So, you know, to always take care of yourself, you know, really listen to yourself. With restlessness, you know, when we just sit still and not move, the less we move the body, the mind can begin to quiet. Like Gulu's snow globe. I love that little snow globe, you know. Eventually, you know, when you shake it, the particles settle at the bottom. If we just don't do anything but sit still. But at times, you know, someone reminded me something I said at another retreat, quoting Jack Kornfield, you know, that sometimes the feeling of restlessness is so strong that, you know, he said, I'll be the first meditator, you know, to die of restlessness, you know, but it feels that way, you know, it just feels like I can't tolerate this, you know. And you know, one of the ways is really feeling that experience in the body. You know, for me, it's like a buzzing in the head sometimes, you know, just like strong buzzing, and we can try to relax into it. But broadening the focus can be one of the remedies. Sometimes we're just too tight, we're striving too hard. And so we give our mind a lot of space, a lot of room. You know, this idea of you put wild horses in a small corral, and they're really unhappy. They're just like, you know, rearing. And you give them a large pasture, and they're just happy and roaming freely. And so we can broaden our focus by listening to sounds. You know, that really makes the mind spacious, and that can really be a very wonderful way to work with restlessness when we're really not able to work with it in more directly. Or we can really shift to a global sense of the body, just something bigger. Another one I'll mention, which I really like, is so simple, is the little, and again, I think Guru mentioned this too, the little turn of the lips and smile. It has such an effect in calming the mind. It's a physiological effect to smile. So even if it feels contrived, you know, and, you know, the first time I did it, just felt, oh gosh, this is so not authentic, you know. but you know, I'm sitting alone with my eyes closed. That's okay. You know, I can handle feeling contrived. and then just beginning to feel the benefit of that, you know, that it just started becoming something that I did just kind of naturally more. And with the hindrance of doubt, the last hindrance, I'm not going to say a lot about it. It can be tricky. You know, we might have doubt in the practice and the teachings, in ourselves. And some doubts that come up might be really useful, worthwhile objects of reflection. And so, but at the right time, not during meditation. It's never the right time during meditation. You know, so it doesn't allow us to apply ourselves. We're no longer practicing if we're trying to figure something out. So very simple. I'll think about this later. Can bring us back to the present moment. You know, really honoring the doubt. You know, it might be a really worthwhile doubt. You know, maybe you really don't know how to do something, or maybe you have doubt in the method you're doing, you need a little more instruction. You know, or for me, I've had doubt about, am I hurting my back by sitting here this long? you know, and then I'll move. If I have that much doubt, I'll move. But really honoring what shows up, you know, and respecting it. And maybe when you think about it later, you go, wow, that was really just a hindrance and didn't have any real substance. You know, especially if we're doubting ourselves, you know, oh, I'll never be able to meditate. You know, I don't think I can ever do this. You know, that kind of doubt is you know, it's not particularly useful. So I want to say a couple of things about how we apply effort. The effort to abandon unskillful qualities needs to be skillful, right? It means that we put out our best effort at any given moment. Even if we're not feeling good or energy's confused or cloudy, sluggish, tired, what's important is the continuity of our best effort, however it is. You know, when the mind's sharp and clear, it's wonderful to put out effort. But when it isn't, you know, what's the best available energy at this moment? What's the best energy available at this moment? And it might be that it's just this little, okay, little tiny little attempt to be mindful. And that's okay. Can be a very gentle effort, a very light touch. And at other times, it might be a heroic effort to stay with like a really intense emotion or something very painful experience. And that requires a heroic effort, requires a lot of energy, a lot of strength. Or maybe in you know, a heroic effort to restrain oneself from yelling at someone we're angry with, that might require a lot of effort. And even if we're overtaken by sloth and torpor, we might notice one breath a minute, you know, but we can just keep directing the mind, just keep coming back. It's about our sincerity. It's really our sincerity, what our best effort is. It can look so different. But we can see inside ourselves, you know, am I really applying my best effort at this moment? Am I being complacent? Am I being indulgent? You know, it can look very different. And as we apply a steady, consistent effort in our practice, when we apply our energy without adding tension, we can find a balance of being both tranquil and alert. And we can relax into what we call an effortless effort, or what athletes and musicians often call the zone. When our efforts are free of desire and aversion, the practice is really satisfying. And then we can go into the deeper meditative states. So the zone is just that, you know, you're there and you're not trying to be there. You're just here. You're just present. You're not practicing. You're present. You're easily present. But we don't enter the state by will. We don't enter the zone by will. We train the mind and we create the conditions, and which allows the effortless effort to rise in its own time. Just like playing a musical instrument, you know, when the effort is just right, it becomes playing music instead of practicing music. When I used to jog, some decades ago now, I jog every day, and every once in a while, I just enter, you know, after a while, I'd enter this state that was just so effortless. I feel like I could jog forever, you know. So this is like one of the fruits of practice, that, you know, we can have periods of effortless effort, and then we go back to the other kind of effort. And it's an art to not crave effortless effort. So we have to be patient. We'll continue to develop patience. Which reminds me of what someone, I don't remember who told me this, but, you know, all these Buddhists, they sit and talk about practice, practice, practice. But when's the performance? So this is effortless effort. So in ending, you know, Ed, I just want to remind you, at every moment, we have a choice of what to do with our minds, regardless of our mental state, regardless of our personal situation. We have a choice. We can either deepen the groove of mindfulness in the brain, supporting the conditions that bring us peace, loving kindness, freedom. Or we can continue to deepen the grooves that keep us struggling. And, you know, Sylvia Burstein told us about a friend of hers. You know, she's a Dharma teacher from, longtime Dharma teacher from Spear Rock. And she had a friend of hers who had been a really longtime practitioner, a good friend of hers who got Alzheimer's. And she went to visit him and his family. And when she got there, he opened the door with this big smile on his face, you know, very warm. He said, "I don't know who you are, but I love you." You know, and that's really, you know, the conditioning of the heart to be free to love. So I love that story. So I'll end with a quote from Ajahn Chah. If you let go a little, you have a little happiness. If you let go of a lot, you'll have a lot of happiness. And if you let go completely, you'll be completely happy. So thank you. Let's share a minute of silence.